Hello, my name is Jeff Zeig, and I am a clinical psychologist in Phoenix, Arizona, also the founder and director of the Milton Erickson Foundation. I want to use this opportunity to talk about a project that is near and dear to me, actually a project that I'm the most passionate about right now as far as my own professional development is concerned, and I call the project the Art and Science of Emotional Impact. The project has really three strands. One strand is to look at the arts, because the arts, well, the arts are about experiential impact. The second strand is to look at science, and what is the neuroscience, what is the social, psychological science, and the academic psychology science that supports the things that creative people have been doing for centuries. And although the creative people have been doing it intuitively, there is good science and very good theory that show that what creative people do does have impact. And the third part, the third strand, is application. And the application part is my part, which is how do we take things from the creative arts and how do we apply them to empower therapeutic communication, but also empower communication in business, empower communication in family life, in everyday life, at those moments that when we want to have emotional impact. If you want to communicate facts, that is the purview of science. And to communicate facts, we can be very straightforward about our communication. And our communication can be logical and didactic, and it will suffice for getting across facts. As a matter of fact, if we were speaking in German, it would probably be better, because German is a more specific language than English. If we were speaking in Chinese, it would probably be worse, because Chinese is a more poetic language than English, or, and certainly, more poetic than German. Now, if we want to get across an experience to people, then we can't use logic. Not in the sense of a didactic, linear, formal logic. If we want to have emotional impact, we enter the experiential world. And the experiential world, and speaking in the experience, speaking in terms of experiential methods, was certainly the purview of Milton Erickson. So I'm going to back up a little bit and say something about my background with Milton Erickson to set the stage. I first met Milton Erickson in 1973. At the time I had my master's degree, I was working as a psychotherapist at a residential treatment center. I was working with severely mentally ill patients. I had worked for many years prior to even getting my master's degree, working with psychotic patients, and as part of my training, early 1970s, 71, 72, I started studying hypnosis, and when I started studying hypnosis, I wanted to learn more about it, and I stumbled on some of the papers by Milton Erickson. There were no real books out at the time. Jay Healy's Uncommon Therapy didn't come out until 1973. So I got a book of Erickson's collected papers. I was stunned. I thought this man was a remarkable genius and was doing things that were light years different from anything that I had learned about or that was conceptualized to me by my teachers as being psychotherapy. So I wrote a frivolous postcard to my cousin who was studying nursing in Tucson. I said, I just started reading Milton Erickson. This man is a genius. If you ever go up to Phoenix, Arizona, which is about 100 miles away, then please visit Milton Erickson. And my cousin wrote me back and she said, Jeff, don't you remember my old roommate in college, Roxana Erickson? And so in perhaps 1970, when my cousin Ellen was living in San Francisco, myself and a friend of mine had met Ellen and Roxana, and we all went out together. I think we went to a Chinese New Year's Day parade, or it could have been a Joan Baez concert. I remember my cousin Ellen pulling me aside and saying, you know, Roxana's father's a famous psychiatrist, and that didn't mean very much to me because at the time I was doing more political organizing against the Vietnam War. So perhaps somewhere in the back of my mind I remembered the name Erickson, but I doubt it. So when my cousin Ellen indicated to me that Roxanne was Dr. Erickson's daughter, I wrote to her, I wrote to Dr. Erickson, I asked if I could come to Phoenix and be his student. And he wrote me back and said that his health was sufficiently rocky that really wasn't possible. And I sent him a copy of a paper that I had written, and it was a paper about using Ericksonian utilization techniques in working with auditory hallucinations in schizophrenic patients. And because of Erickson's technique and writing me and my motivation, in 1973 I came to Phoenix for the first of a number of trips. From 1973 until 1978 I traveled as frequently as I could to Phoenix, spending 3 to 5 days trying to learn more from Dr. Erickson. And then eventually in 1978 I moved to Phoenix, really to be closer to Dr. Erickson. I think that I offered my first workshop in 1976 or 1977. And since 1978, I've been traveling internationally to some 40 different countries and primarily teaching about Dr. Erickson and his work because I found it so fascinating. I remember the first moment that I walked into Dr. Erickson's office in 1973. I arrived late, and somehow I was going to be his house guest. I don't even remember how that was arranged, but he had a very small guest house, and there was a small bedroom, and I was going to occupy that bedroom during the 3 days that I was visiting him for that first visit. And I arrived late at night, and I walked in the door, and Roxy greeted me, and she said, "This is my father, Dr. Erickson," and there was Dr. Erickson seated immediately to my left. And that shocked me because, one, he was seated to my immediate left, and two, he was wearing purple. And being a person who was colorblind, he wore purple. He was also confined to a wheelchair, so his family needed to make for him clothes that would be easy to help him to dress. Wearing street clothes would have been difficult, so the kind of clothes he wore, they were like purple leisure suits or purple pajamas. And as I looked to my immediate left, Dr. Erickson slowly and mechanically raised his head vertically, and then slowly and mechanically moved his head horizontally, caught my eyes, probably defocused his gaze, probably looked through me, perhaps paced my breathing rhythm, and then slowly and mechanically looked vertically down the midline of my body, indicating go down inside. Now, Roxana grabbed me by the arm at that moment, took me into the next room, and explained that her father was a practical joker. But it was no practical joke. It was a complete induction of hypnosis. It was a nonverbal induction of hypnosis, and if there was ever a moment that I was going to have a stuporous plenary trance, it would have been that moment. I had no resource to deal with that. Nobody had ever said hello to me like that, and I was completely disrupted from my normal pattern of how one human being says hello to another human being. But it was only years later that I could reflect back about that and say that this was a typical Ericksonian introduction, and I was introduced into an experiential world. And this world was going to be one where people would grow and change by virtue of the experiences that they have and not by virtue of the information that they're given. Again, information is fine if you want to learn mathematics, if you want to learn physics, if you want to learn about chemistry, but if you want to learn how to be happy, well, information is not the royal road. If you want to learn how to love, if you want to learn how to be motivated, how to be curious, how to be eager, all of those things, these states, they are things that are created by the experiences that we have, not by the information that we're given. And quite to my own embarrassment, it took me quite a while to understand the essentially experiential impact of Dr. Erickson. Now, I was Dr. Erickson's student for 6.5 years, traveling frequently to Phoenix and then eventually moving here to Phoenix. And over that 6.5 years, he never, and I would say that that's not hyperbole, gave me much, and gave me didactic information. Well, I guess it is a little hyperbole, because now that I say that, I can think of some of the things that he did teach me in a more didactic way. Dr. Erickson and I spent 5 hours on two occasions, a total of 5 hours, going over a 50-minute induction, which appears as a transcript to the book, A Teaching Seminar with Milton Erickson, the first book that I edited. And in that book, Dr. Erickson was much more didactic and explicit about the kind of effect that he was trying to have with his method. But mostly over the 6.5 years that I knew Dr. Erickson, he gave me experiences. And these experiences, well, they were like stories or metaphors or snippets of poems or tasks that I would do, or they were hypnosis. And it was as if he would be dropping, moment after moment after moment, these little experiences in my lap. And it would be up to me to unwrap these experiences, live those experiences, and by virtue of living those experiences, I would be different. Now, I can't even begin to imagine who I would be right now if it were not for the enormous impact that Dr. Erickson had to me during those especially formative years. And then I have searched and been teaching about Ericksonian methods for well over 30 years, and I've searched for models for how to understand and how to utilize this orientation to being experiential. And what I have struck on is art, and understanding art as a quintessential model of what it is like to be experiential, because, well, art, it's about being experiential, it's not about giving people information. Let's just take poetry for a moment. One of my favorite poets is Robert Frost, and he wrote a poem about trees. Robert Frost wrote that a poem should enter with delight and exit with wisdom. I'll tell you from memory just a few stanzas from that poem by Robert Frost. He wrote, "Tree at my window, window tree. Your sash is lowered when night comes on, but let there never be curtain drawn between you and me. Vague dream head lifted out of ground, and thing next most diffuse to cloud, not all of your light tongues speaking aloud could be profound." Now, those are remarkable images, and that communication is completely weird. You can't walk around saying to people, "Tree at my window, window tree." You can't talk about the leaves of a tree as being light tongues, or the substance of a tree being a vague dream head that's lifted out of ground. So essentially, experiential communication, by its very intent, needs to be weird. And that's an awfully difficult thing for psychotherapists to understand. But if you think about it, well, human problems, they're pretty weird. And why waste good intellectual linear logic on a problem that is, by its very nature, weird? And so if we think about fighting fire with fire, then we can begin to use communication that's weird in order to have emotional impact. I would challenge each and every one of you to watch any popular movie and to watch the movie from the perspective of that movie is completely weird. And as technology increases in the cinematic business, movies get increasingly weird because the job of the movie is to involve you not in a story, yes, but also to present things in ways that keep you interested. So the way in which the cuts are made in the movie, the camera shots, these are not anything that we would see in normal life. Movies are inherently weird. They're inherently about experiences. They're not about trying to transmit information. But then it's the same thing if you think about art, that art is weird, and that paintings are not attempting to be photographs of reality. They're attempting to give you an impression of some aspect of reality. Because again, if you want to influence mood and perspective, you are entering into an experiential world. So over the past few years, I have been deconstructing art, and I have been looking at the techniques that artists use and thinking about how to apply them to into the warp and woof of psychotherapy. And I've been working on a book on the project. Not only that, I've been working on a documentary on this project. Recently, I was in Hollywood and I met with a very, very, very excellent director, James Foley, who's done 11 feature films and worked with actors such as Dustin Hoffman and Al Pacino and Halle Berry and Bruce Willis and Jack Lemmon. And we videotaped a discussion between Mr. Foley and myself in which we looked at 3 minutes of the opening of his film, Perfect Stranger, and we deconstructed that film into the core experiential elements, the microdynamic experiential elements. For example, one thing that movies are based on is discontinuity and misdirection. They're based on some degree of destabilization. So in the very opening of the movie, there's a series of discontinuities. You are seeing objects, you don't even know what those objects are that you're looking at. You're seeing strange patterns of movement, you don't know what they are. But these kind of discontinuities, well, they're fascinating. Now, if we immediately switch over into the idea of application, we can start to think about Milton Erickson and one of the main contributions that he made into the psychological, into the psychotherapy arts, which was the use of a confusion technique. Erickson published about the confusion technique in, I believe, 1963 or 1964, and he talked about using methods of destabilization. Now, jokes are based on destabilization, and there needs to be a moment of destabilization for a joke to work. For example, I live in Phoenix, which is a kind of gerontopolis because it's one of the places in the United States where we send our old people, and they live in ghettos. There are cities surrounding Phoenix where, unless you're 55, you can't live in that city. And so a lot of Phoenix is very new. So we have a joke about Phoenix, fifth biggest city in the United States. We say, what's the difference between Phoenix and yogurt? And the difference is the yogurt has active culture. Now that joke works if you have a moment of confusion in which you realize that there's a double entendre around the word culture. And so Eric Byrne, when he was writing his game formula, and Groucho Marx, Harpo Marx, so any comedian realizes that there needs to be a movement of arousal and a movement of destabilization. And once we realize this, then we can begin to apply that into the moments in which we want to have impact. We can't have impact just by talking about it. And so in a hypnotic induction, I might talk with a patient about how you can glow into trance And does it matter if the person will go into trance or glow into trance or grow into trance? And by creating momentary destabilization, you both capture attention and you energize the moment, and especially you energize the moment following the application of tension, of little movements that create tension. Now, there are myriad ways of creating momentary destabilization, not only by using a kind of stutter step, but by using your body, by using the direction of your voice, by using the tone of your voice. And I have been increasingly looking at the ways in which during the complex weave of communication, that at moments when I want to have emotional impact, that like a movie maker, I might use a little bit of destabilization. In doing this documentary, one of the other people who I interviewed was Philip Zimbardo, the great social psychologist. And what I did with Phil was I played the first opening minute and a half of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And we listened to what Beethoven did, which was immediately spring into action. So the fate theme, ba-ba-ba-bum, that's presented immediately, and Beethoven is springing into action. Now, when Tolstoy wrote Anna Karenina, he did the same thing, and in contrast to Herman Melville, who wrote 400 pages of description and background before you got to the incident with the whale, Tolstoy did something that was unique and was different from the customary formulation of how novelists would write at the time. He sprung into action. Hundreds of pages later, you would find out that Count Vorosky was bald. But in the opening, he just springs into action, and that was something different. Now, that was something different in Milton Erickson, because if you saw Milton Erickson, he might not spend time getting subjective tests and objective tests and a social history and other diagnostic information. He immediately sprang into action, and Erickson would advise his students, do your hypnotic induction in the first half of the session, talk about things in the second half of the session. And this was part of that experiential mentality. So when I was talking with Phil Zimbardo, I said, okay, Phil, this idea of spring into action, if you're teaching a social psychology class, you being a preeminent teacher, how would you take that principle from Beethoven, and how would you use that? And Phil could immediately get into the improvisation of the moment and talk about how he might spring into action in teaching the class rather than setting things up. Well, then I played for him the opening of Chopin's Polonaise in A-flat, and Chopin, in introducing that Polonaise, holds off the theme. And so in the opening of the Polonaise, it's like da 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 da. And I said, okay, Phil, then in comparison, when might you want to do something like holding off the theme to build up emotional drama as you were coming to something that you really wanted the students to get experientially and not didactically? And Phil could immediately step up into that moment. And then I said, well, listen to Beethoven's theme again, the fate theme, ba-ba-ba-bum, and listen to what Beethoven does. And what he does is immediately he uses recursions, because repetition, well, that's boring to the human neurobiological system, but recursions, those become interesting and they capture more of our attention. So how could you use recursions in teaching? And Phil could immediately step up into that, and we had our interview as this kind of improv. So the point of the matter is that in the creative arts there are numerous dissociative and associative techniques. And these dissociative and associative techniques are used because artists know this is the way to have experiential impact. In science, a second thread to my project, there are neurobiological understandings of why we need emotional stimulation and why discontinuities and destabilization works. And so I have been interviewing and have scheduled to interview many of the great neuroscientists who could help to elucidate information about that project. And there are understandings of areas of social psychology like priming. And priming demonstrates that you can do very subtle things that awaken representations, representations that guide our perceptions, representations that guide our behavior, representations that even guide our motivation, and representations that can be enduring. So the three threads of the project are, one, to look at the microdynamics of what it is that creative people do, what can we take from the creative arts and apply into the healing arts or apply into the coaching arts. And so I am studying creative people, and I invite you to do the same, study creative people, and look at the things, the microdynamics of what creative people do. For example, my wife and I saw the movie Precious just the other day. And in this movie, in the opening scene, there's a lamppost and there's a red scarf around the lamppost. And then there's a jump cut, a discontinuity. And then you see this red scarf as it starts to float down. And shortly after that, there's a fantasy by this terribly abused girl who finds a way of coping with the horrible abuse that she's had by living in some fantasy, moving herself into fantasy at those times of abuse. But before we even know about that, there's this kind of fairy godmother creature who puts a red scarf around her neck. And in subsequent scenes, we see her wearing a red scarf, and this poor depraved child who doesn't have very much and at least has that red scarf. Now, we don't see that. And I would say that out of 100 people who watched that movie, 99 of them would never see those three fragments in the opening scene, and they wouldn't put much credence to those three fragments, because in those three fragments you just are seeing a lamppost and you have no idea why that red scarf is there, and in the jump cut you have no idea why it's floating down, and then you have no idea why this fairy godmother is coming in and what it means. And they're just dissociated moments in which tension is created. Well, 90 minutes later into the movie, in a very simple but poignant scene, the abused girl takes that red scarf and she wraps that around the neck of an equally abused friend of hers and gives her something to make her feel respected, loved, appreciated. And so there was this artist, and this artist was priming, seeding in advance an intervention that wasn't going to happen until 90 minutes later in the movie. Now, this was Milton Erickson. So there were myriad examples in which Erickson would seed a concept, and he would return to that concept, if not 90 minutes later, even weeks later. Because Erickson studied what artists do, and he was able to model some of those methods and think that, well, if Thomas Mann could use foreshadowing, if a great composer could use an overture, and that the impact of foreshadowing increases the possibility that a later presentation of the prime will have more emotional impact. Now, studies of priming have demonstrated effects like this, except that the way of applying that has been limited to the arts and hasn't found its way into the psychological arts, except in the case of Milton Erickson, who out of all of the therapists I've studied was the only one who really regularly used priming. And now in social psychology there is research that shows undoubtedly that priming is something that does have an effect. So the three threads of my project are, one, to look into the creative arts and look at the microdynamics of what creative artists do, extract those things that creative artists do. Second thread is to meet with scientists, neuroscientists, social psychologists, academic psychologists, and talk about the research and the theory that demonstrates that the things that that artists do are part of the human social, biological, neurological system. And then the third piece of the project is to look into applications, and that's been my job. My job has been to look into the applications and how we can take techniques from the arts and apply them into the healing arts, apply them into our everyday life. So I hope that I've piqued a little bit of your interest in that. And it has been a project that I have a lot of passion for. One, because it's been such an interesting way of learning to study about painting and choreography and architecture and interior design and set design and lighting design and cinematography and try to understand what do these people know, what can be codified about emotional impact by studying their methods. But also it's been a culmination of a journey to find a model of how to explain the ingenuity of Milton Erickson. Recently teaching an introductory psychology, an introductory hypnosis class, I started by showing one of James Foley's movies. And we looked at a 5-minute segment and we deconstructed it. And then we talked about the nature of hypnosis and how the nature of hypnosis is essentially about experiential impact. And that if we could understand experiential impact in hypnosis, we could understand experiential impact in a more naturalistic way in psychotherapy and also in everyday life. So the project helps me immensely to have a model, finally, that more adequately explains what Milton Erickson was about. And so what I hope that I've piqued your interest in is learning more about Milton Erickson and his experiential approach. And also I hope that I've piqued your interest to learning about art and thinking about how to be a kind of corporate raider, take ideas, methods, ways of thinking from art and applying them into everyday life. So thanks for the opportunity, and thanks to Rob for all of his work in making this project possible, to Rob and Peter both. Thank you so much.